Hello, friends. Welcome back to another episode of Theology in the Raw. My name is Preston Sprinkle, and my guest for today's show is Lindsay Snyder. Lindsay Snyder works for Equip Ministries. She is the content creator and donor relations officer. She has a degree from Taylor University. She graduated in 2014 with a BA in film and media production. She's currently working towards a master's in social work, and her goal is to become a counselor and journey with others like her who are navigating the tension between their Christian faith and sexuality. I came across Lindsay's work because she wrote a series of blogs for Equip Ministries. So equipyourcommunity.org is the website or the URL you can go to find this blog series. And I'm friends with Peter Volk, who was on the show recently, who runs Equip. And Lindsay wrote a series of blogs on female sexuality for Equip Ministries. And they were so good. They were so incredibly good. There's like four or five blogs that she has over the last year. And it talks about the uniqueness, the complexity of female sexuality, both from her own lived experience as somebody who is attracted to the same sex, and also from the perspective of somebody who's really smart and well-read and has done a lot of research on this topic as well. And that's the focus of our time together, is talking about the uniqueness, the complexity, and the beauty of female sexuality. And we do get into a topic that I've been wanting to talk about on the show for a while, and yet it's a topic that, for various reasons, I feel a little nervous just kind of waxing eloquent from my own straight maleness, and that is the topic of the rise in teenage females identifying not as lesbian, but as bisexual or pansexual. And we get into that probably the latter half of the show, talk about why younger females are more likely to identify as bisexual than lesbian, or even sometimes straight. I mean, I feel like sometimes the bisexual identity is almost more common than a straight identity among some context among teenage females. If you would like to support the show, you can go to patreon.com/TheologyInTheRaw. Support the show for as little as $5 a month. Become part of the Theology in the Raw community, and get access to premium content and other goodies that come along with it. Also, this is both a YouTube and an audio podcast. So if you're watching on YouTube, hi, you can see my absolutely hideous monstrosity of a basement that I record in. If you're listening just on the podcast and you think I'm in this nice studio with, you know, kombucha on tap and a finished ceiling, but those of you who are watching see a bunch of unfinished rafters and are those clothespins? I don't know. I'm hanging laundry in here, apparently. I don't know why I do know why there's clothespins there. That's a whole nother story. But if you want to watch this conversation, you can go to my YouTube channel at Preston Sprinkle. If you're watching, you can go to my podcast at Theology in the Raw. If you don't want to or can't support the show, please do leave a review. Reviews do help alert people to this show. It brings awareness to the show. And please consider sharing this episode or other episodes that you have appreciated on your social media accounts. Okay, let's have a very fascinating and interesting conversation about female sexuality with Lindsay Snyder. Hello, friends. Welcome back to another episode of Theology in the Raw. My name is Preston. I'm here with I almost said friend, but we've been looking at each other for about 2 minutes, and that's the extent of our face-to-face-ish relationship. But I've known about Lindsay for at least over a year, and we almost spoke at an event. Well, we almost did an event together that got canceled due to COVID. Anyway, Lindsay, so good to have you on Theology in the Raw.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm really excited to be here and just share my story and some of my experiences.
Cool. Why don't we start there? Why don't you just give, most people probably haven't heard of your name unless we're getting some people over from, you know, your ministry, but tell us your story and we'll go from there.
Yeah. Always interesting to figure out where to start and how to condense things, but there's always, or you often hear, I always felt a little different, and that is the same for me, growing up, and didn't know what it was, thought all of my friends were just boy crazy, and I was the normal one, of course. So I remember like going to sleepovers and, friends would be like, oh yeah, I'm looking for this quality in a guy when I get married and this quality. And I really am attracted to, guy's eyes or whatever. And, I would be like, they'd be like, and what about you? Like, what qualities are you looking for? And I'd be like, all the things you just said, I don't know. Like, yeah. So I was very confused. growing up, I found at 14, around 14, I was attracted to a girl in my youth group. And that was super confusing. I had not heard pretty much anything about sexuality. I had no education around that topic, whether from my parents or my church, really. And so everything was foreign to me. I was very naive, and very scared. So I actually told my parents, surprisingly, like right at first, and they were like, oh, it's just a phase. They meant well, of course. I don't want to throw my parents under the bus. They just were like, oh, it's probably just another of your worries, your anxieties, paranoia. It'll be fine. So I took that on, and really latched onto that for the next 10 years. And I honestly, looking back, don't know how I suppressed it for that long.
Lindsay, really quick, can you give us your age just so we have kind of a general time frame context? Yeah.
Yeah, so, I'm 28.
20, okay. So 10.
So when I was 14 was when I first really noticed attraction to girls. And then 10 years later, I kind of came out to myself, finally. going through high school, college, attractions would come up, of course, but I would be like, nope, that's going to go right in that little box that I have in my head and I'm never going to look at it. And hope it'll just go away eventually. They're just fear and shame, of course, is just they're powerful motivators. Not good ones, but they're powerful. So I think that's how it was just suppressed for so long.
And you were raised in a Christian home or like in the church?
I was. Okay. Yes. Yes. I grew up with my parents actually started the church that I like grew up in or it helped start. So it almost felt like I was a pastor's kid.
Yeah. In Nashville or?
In East Tennessee, Morristown. I don't know if you've heard of that.
I was just Chattanooga, Cleveland, Tennessee. Is that close?
Okay.
That's kind of, that's more South Tennessee, I guess.
Yeah. Not quite there, but near Knoxville.
Okay. Okay. Cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you came out at, so that you were 24 when you came out to yourself, even though you had these desires, you're wrestling with stuff. Did you ever like date guys or date girls during that time? Or were you a non-dater for 10 years?
Yeah, it was very strange. I would kind of take on around my friends this, this persona of being like the awkward one, around anything to do with sexuality or dating or anything. I just kind of found a place for myself in this is going to sound weird, but like being laughed at, but of course sometimes that would go like too far and I would be like, ouch, that hurt. but I didn't know why exactly. I didn't end up dating. Oh, I went on one date. Sorry. I went on one date with a guy in college. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, nope. but there was like a desire to date, but it was almost like by suppressing my attraction to women, I was suppressing my sexuality entirely. I just didn't want to look at it at all.
Okay. And did you, so if you could reflect back on those, I guess the 10 years from 14 to 24,
mm-hmm.
And I don't want to go like all Kinsey scale or whatever, but you would say you were not at all attracted to guys, totally 100% girls, or was there a little bit of in-betweenness or maybe overlap at all, or?
Yeah, I think in college I did experience some attraction to guys, which was, I guess, a relief to me. It felt like, oh, maybe I'm getting to be more normal. But then when I finally came out to myself, it was like, I'm sure you've heard of, like, it just feels like you're going through puberty all of a sudden.
Mm-hmm.
I had suppressed that part of me for so long that it just felt like everything exploded, and I was attracted to like every woman, not really every woman, but it was very intense and very kind of overwhelming. And my attraction really shifted towards mostly women until I started dating a guy later on, when I was 26.
Okay. Yeah. So what's the last, the last 4 years from the time you came out, 24 to now you're 28. What are those 4 years? And then wrestling with your faith, and what does this mean for my life and future and my walk with Jesus and all that. So what did those 4 years look like?
Those were the first couple of years especially, were very tumultuous. I didn't really know how to express my emotions at all regarding my attractions, but the only way I could think of was to write. And so I wrote a story. I don't know if you're familiar with the movie Inside Out.
No.
Okay. It's an animated Pixar movie, and it's basically about these emotions that are inside someone's head, and they have like these conversations, and they go on this adventure. It sounds really weird to put it that way, but I kind of took that concept and applied it to my own life and same-sex attraction or gayness became a character. My anxiety was a character, anger, depression, different things. And I wrote this story that ended up being like 50 pages long of just me. I was a character in the story as well, me interacting with these different parts of myself. And I would bring that into my therapist, and I would just read it out loud to her, what I'd written. And that was very healing for me in terms of emotionally being able to process. But then I had to figure out all the theological stuff. And at that point, I really needed to do like a theological deep dive. So I did that because my faith was important to me. And I really needed to know what God thought about this and how I could act. And, you know, I thought initially that I knew what the conclusion would be, but I was like, I'm just going to try to be objective about this and hope for the best. And my hope, of course, was that I would find that God would bless same-sex relationships, same-sex marriages. That is not what I found. But I went through all the books and all the articles and podcasts, just searching and searching and searching. I was like, I just got to find one thing that'll make me believe that God's okay with it. But
that is fascinating. I mean,
yeah,
you were, unless somebody questions the genuineness of what you're saying, it can't be like, well, like you were not wanting to see this. You were really wanting to, like you had lenses on that prevented you from seeing the full light of God's expansive vision for same-sex relationships or, Have you wondered why you, approaching the scriptures, wanting to see something, did not see it there, whereas somebody else is approaching the scriptures and sees it a different way? I mean, I guess there's no answer to that. It's just I'm fascinated, just almost from a psychological perspective, on why do some people become convinced of a same-sex sexual ethic, a more progressive sexual ethic, and some don't. You know, it can't just be the overwhelming persuasiveness of, you know, the arguments for, you know, same-sex marriage.
Right.
I don't know.
Right. Yeah, that is a really good and tough question. Could you like condense that question?
I'm just kind of maybe responding. I guess let me ask, like, why weren't you convinced of a same an affirming view of same-sex relations?
Yeah. I mean, personally, I thought that there was a lot of, first there was no positive, example of a same-sex marital relationship in scripture. Of course, the cultural context, there were those arguments, regarding that such a thing would not exist. But, I ultimately, it was the metaphor of Christ and the church that really solidified probably the theological piece for me. And that was, there's something about God and how he relates to us that is about unity and difference, not unity and sameness. Mm-hmm. And there can be differences between people of the same gender, sex. But God also, in scripture, takes this very, he has a very high view of our bodies too. And some of that is a mystery to me. Like, I don't know why it's so important, but yeah, the one flesh union and the, unity in difference and how that's an essential element of who God says he is in relation to us was probably the clincher for me. Mm-hmm. And I really didn't like that because I was like, I'm doing all this for a metaphor, really? Mm. Like, like, God, can't you just like change the metaphor a little bit? Like, is that really a big deal? But yeah, I'm a very like poetic and romantic person. And so I guess like that argument would not work for everyone, but, metaphorically, like metaphors are very powerful and important to me because they help me make sense of things. And while that metaphor still doesn't make complete sense, mm-hmm. I knew it was important. Yeah. And if we're talking about the nature of God and his relationship to us, like that is what we are imaging. And mm-hmm. like, I didn't want to live out the like a different movie trailer for the movie that we're going to experience in heaven.
Yeah, I know that's helpful. Yeah. I didn't prepare you for, make sure come with your theological defense. I'm always curious when, cause somebody, you know, the fact that I hold to a traditional sexual ethic, even though I know my own journey and I know that I held both mm-hmm. views with a very open hand and was willing to go with whichever one I found to be most compelling. And I've done that with several other theological positions and changed my view and lost some tribal identities, you know, with certain groups. Right. And I just, I don't care. Like that doesn't drive me, to make sure I secure my tribal identity. So, So I know I approached it with as fair of a perspective as I mm-hmm. could have, you know, and we all still have biases and stuff, but somebody still could say, yeah, you're a straight male and married, all this stuff. You're mm-hmm. come from, you know, my unbiasedness, you know, whatever, isn't really convincing for people. But when you come at it and say, mm-hmm. I wanted to see this and I have grounds to want to see it, and still didn't, that's always, fascinating. And it's just one little footnote, I guess. What's interesting, you know, you brought up the cultural context, like same-sex mm-hmm. marriage wasn't a possibility. So that's why it wasn't even on the table. That's actually not totally accurate.
Especially
with women. Oftentimes the argument is very male-centered, mm-hmm. which is ironic because people that are typically otherwise progressive are relying on a very patriarchal, male-centered piece of evidence. They look at all the male same-sex relationships in and around the first century, and most of them are, not all, but a lot of them have these power differentials. But when it comes to female same-sex relationships in the ancient world, we have examples of all kinds of consensual, even marriage-like relationships, both from archaeology and literary evidence and stuff. So, So I don't think that I think understanding the cultural context is important, but I think it's often overplayed as people employ the argument. But that's not why we're here, Lindsay. I want to dive into. Okay, so you're on the other side of your theological journey. And so what would the next, I guess, the last 2 years, so that was your first 2 years, 24 to 26. I'm a numbers guy, so I got to.
Yeah. No, that's great.
You fell into this kind of, it sounds like a reluctant yet clear, like, okay, I feel confident this is what God desires for me and doesn't desire for me. So what did the last two years of your life kind of look like in that part of your journey?
Yeah, well, I was very angry and very, very bitter and was like, God, why did you even bring me on this journey if this is the result? Like, if I can't, it just felt pointless to find this so-called missing puzzle piece of myself. And then it felt like I had to just hold it instead of putting it in the puzzle forever for the rest of my life. And so it was like, wow, God, you just gave me a bunch of pain to hold when I could have just suppressed it. But of course, suppression was not a permanent solution and would not have been helpful. So, yeah, so I kind of wrestled with anger with God for a very, very, very long time. Even to this day, like, I can still have times of bitterness and just because of the lack of emotional congruency with what I believe to be true versus what I feel to be true. Yeah, but it, like, God's kindness really pursued me during the really, really dark times where I, like, turned to just maladaptive ways of coping. Mm-hmm. Just these things would happen that wouldn't make sense. I think, like, there was, I'll give one example. There was one time where I was just doing a really poor job at work because I was just focused on this coming out journey. And I was, going to maladaptive coping stuff. And I was just doing a really poor job for a long time. And on a particularly terrible day, I found out that I got a raise and I was like, wait, this makes no sense whatsoever. And I think somehow God reminded me through that he's not like a punitive God in that he doesn't love us or give us good things based on our actions all the time and our obedience to him, but that he loves to give good gifts to his children. and it sometimes is not based at all on what we do or don't do. And I don't know, just things like that, that really showed God's kindness mm-hmm. in ways that didn't make sense. So I guess I had the sexuality metaphor piece that didn't make sense that I was angry about, but there was also this God's kindness on the other end of the spectrum that also didn't make sense, but was true. So I don't know. There
That's
was this
good.
This sense of things cannot make sense but be true at the same time.
And so where are you at now? Catch us up to the last couple of weeks or month of Lindsay's life.
Yeah.
How are you doing?
Yeah. Well, I do want to mention that I did have a few experiences with dating guys through the past several years.
Okay.
At first, I was like, oh, well, I guess I might as well try dating a guy and see what happens. And I didn't expect anything to happen. But to my surprise, I was not initially physically attracted to my ex-boyfriend, but then I was, which was also a super confusing experience for me because I was like, wait, I thought I was gay. Like, why? How? Am I forcing this? But I wasn't. And so then I just felt like a fraud, kind of. So there's that whole piece. And then my second experience with dating was with a well, I don't want to get too much into other people's stories, but
I don't want you to blow confidentiality if you're trying to protect somebody.
No, not at all. Yeah. Not at all. No. Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Like, yeah, let's not go there.
Yeah.
But yeah.
So that, I guess that's a good segue into what I really want to talk to you about. Not that sounds so bad. I don't care about your story. I just, but your story is so intertwined with this topic of female sexuality, the complexity of female sexuality, the uniqueness, and to quote, a phrase that psychologists often use, the fluidity of female sexuality. I've been, and it's always weird as a straight guy, even having an interest in female sexuality and the flexibility of it compared to typical male sexuality. I'll never forget. I was taking my kids to some sporting, I think they were rock climbing or something. And I was sitting there, reading a book, and I was reading Sexual Fluidity, Understanding a Woman's Love and Desire by Lisa Diamond. And it has this kind of picture of this woman on the front, a little bit like sensual. And I'm reading this book and I'm getting this. That's it. It is such a profound book. And I'm reading this and getting strange looks, And I'm like, no, really, I'm not that guy. I'm another that guy, who you wouldn't understand anyway. But
another that guy.
I was blown away. For those who aren't familiar with this book, Lisa Diamond is a lesbian psychologist who specializes in female sexual orientation. And this study is a result of a 10-year following of 100 women. I think all of them at the beginning identified it as non-straight. Okay. Some were they weren't straight. And all throughout those 10 years, to her dismay almost, I think, don't quote me on this, but it was something like only 3% of them had the same identity, because she'd check in every 2 years and say, all right. And how are they identified at the beginning? Only 3% had the same identity 10 years later. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them that had non-straight kind of attractions, whether it was bisexual or same sex, those flexed and were fluid. And it's exactly what you said, to your surprise. Mm-hmm. I wasn't trying to do this. It's just something happened. I met a guy who wasn't a jerk, or just a different kind of guy, or whatever. I didn't want to all of a sudden I felt kind of attracted maybe on an emotional level to a guy, and then maybe that led to more physical or sexual, maybe not, but there was just, there was shifts and changes. Did you, okay, so all that to say, for, to kind of set it up for the audience, I mean,
yeah,
so
yeah.
that,
yeah.
And then I find out that that's fairly, like her work's very widely accepted, and there's, she's not the only one saying mm-hmm. this. When you read that book, did that, does that resonate with you? Because I just, yeah. for me, it's like, I'm looking at it from a distance. I want to know, like, how did you react?
Right. So I'm actually just now, I should have read this a long time ago, but I'm just now reading it.
Oh, okay.
yeah, so, but I did come across like this particular paragraph that I was like, huh, this, yeah, this sounds like me. where it says that for women with non-exclusive attractions, fixed identities may never completely succeed in representing the complicated situation-specific and sometimes relationship-specific nature of their sexual self-concepts. Perhaps for these women, adopting a flexible, changeable identity is the most mature, adaptive way of understanding their sexuality. In such cases, even a bisexual identity may not capture the complexity of their desires. And I was like, huh, yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. And is uncomfortable because I'm like, it should be that my sexual orientation should be fixed. And I don't know, there's something in me that is like, otherwise I'm a fraud, or otherwise I am just kidding myself. And so that's the feeling that arises within me, but in actuality, that is more what it's like, what I just read.
Okay. Well, that fraud, that feeling of a fraud that only, just again, kind of thinking out loud here, but that is only the case if you come at this with a prior assumption kind of handed to us from culture that you are either gay or straight. And if you're gay, that's just this monolithic kind of thing. And if you're straight, that's, and yeah, there's some that are bisexual that are both, but even that, some, I think understanding bisexuality doesn't appreciate the, even the flexibility or fluidity there. And so I could imagine, and then there is this push to have an identity. Who are you? Mm-hmm. Which sexual category do you fit into? You must fit into one. Right. Find it. Discover who you are. And I think that
even
whole,
in order, even in order to belong,
Right. An identity is a key and entry. It's a key to, and you know, open the door to belong to a certain community. And that's just, I just, in my growing understanding, sexuality is just way more complicated. And I hesitate saying flexible, but I'm going to say it. I mean, Van, I think we appreciate. And I know half the audience right now is in the back of their mind. They're thinking, okay, so is conversion therapy, are you guys, is that where you guys are going? Is this a resurrection of ex-gay? And she addresses this and she says the massive difference is everything I'm talking about. It happens unintentionally through environmental shifts and changes in relationships. This is not you even trying to change your sexuality, or not somebody else even more so trying to change it. It's just the natural flow and rhythm and complexity of life. Is that how you understand the difference maybe there? Because
For sure. Yeah. Like if I was trying to force myself, or if someone else tried to force me, that would have zero effect. I'm positive on my sexual orientation. Because even with the example of my ex, just, it was so shocking to me, that I developed attraction. It was just, it was very much an organic thing.
Why is it that, well, let me say, it seems like most women I meet, again, this is anecdotally, I'm sure there's studies done on this, but I would say most, in my experience, more than 50% of women I meet that are same-sex attracted on some level have had some kind of like bad experience with men, bad, you know, maybe it's been an abusive situation. Maybe it's just been a jerk of men in their life. Maybe they, I don't know, like that's been my, has that been your majority, like in your talk to other women, I guess, and then I would love to hear your thoughts on that. If you feel like you've had a negative view of men in your past that might have played some, I don't want to say played some role. I'm not even going to make that connection yet. I just it's an interesting observation.
I would say it's kind of mixed. I know a lot of gay women, bisexual women, queer women who have had really bad experiences with men. Mm-hmm. Some very traumatic, others just a bunch of negative interactions. But then I know some others who have not necessarily had that.
Okay.
And have had good experiences with men in their life and have developed really solid friendships. And so I wouldn't see that as like a rule,
okay,
but maybe as like a more often than not.
Yeah.
Maybe.
And I want to be so careful and just to be
yeah.
Hopefully this is clear. I'm not suggesting that every person who's same-sex attracted, it's connected to some environmental thing. I mean, I feel like I've said that so many times in writing in public that I shouldn't say it again, but
yeah,
if somebody's listening for the first time, I am not at all saying that, because I know a lot of straight people that have had really negative interactions with the opposite sex and they're still straight. So you can't draw a correlation. I just wonder in some cases, well, certainly it's true in some, you have to say in some cases, there has been, you know, when somebody meets somebody of the opposite sex that is very different and embodies more of a Christ-like kind of posture, that it would be more likely for them to cultivate a kind of attraction to that person than not, if they've had negative experiences. But
And for me personally, I did not necessarily have tons of negative experiences with guys. Before dating guys, I would say after dating guys, I did. So I'm kind of working through now. I'm working through this weird, like, new bitterness I have towards guys. It's strange, but so it definitely wasn't the case for me that I was influenced by that initially.
Okay.
I might be influenced a little bit by it now, to be honest.
I want to talk about bisexuality now. And here's a question I've been wanting to ask somebody. And it's one of the main reasons why I wanted to have you on, because I read your stuff. And I think you have such a helpful and healthy and thoughtful perspective on this. My question is this: why does it seem, and I think it's even been justified by the statistics now, why is it that there has been a I would say a fairly strong increase among teenage females identifying as not lesbian, not straight, but bisexual, or some might even say pansexual? I don't know if people who identify as pan would be able to identify the difference necessarily, because that deals with like theological anthropology and a view of human nature that most teenagers haven't, you know, read Foucault and, you know, first of all, am I right to say, man, it seems like there's a lot compared to like 5-10 years ago, a lot more teenage females identifying as bi or pan than ever before. And why is that?
I think that is true. In my experience, I didn't know anyone who was bi or like in high school. There was just a rare thing to hear about any woman being bi. But now, like, I work with an organization, EQIP, and we do hear quite often parents bring up that their daughters are experiencing and identifying as bisexual, and that's just been a really common experience lately. And so why that is, I think one reason is that it's just becoming more acceptable and more even admirable to be open about your sexuality and to be who you are, to not hide that. And I think yeah, it's just less scary to mm-hmm. come out as bi. Mm-hmm. I think another reason does have to do with the sexual fluidity piece, it's just female sexuality is so complicated, so complex, and so influenced by so many different factors, and just so hard to pin down that it can be helpful to be able to find a term that can kind of try to encompass all of those experiences. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can you unpack the complexity? Like when you say it's complex, what
yeah.
help us understand that.
So I don't want to make blanket statements, but in general, what I see anyway, is that often, like if we compare male sexuality and female sexuality, for instance, like male sexuality is typically, I would say, driven primarily by physical attraction. I did a lot of research for one of my posts on this. For women, determining sexual orientation feels very different. Mm-hmm. So generally, it's much more nuanced and more holistic, even initially. So like an initial attraction is likely not to be just a physical one, but also emotional or social, or there's more factors in play. And so in that sense, it is more complicated, I think. Mm-hmm. And then there's a sense of men have this strong, what is called like a category specific sexual arousal pattern, which is very clear to that they're aroused by either one sex or the other sex. Mm-hmm. And there's just a clear differential. But yeah, there's been studies that show that even most straight women are equally sexually aroused by both men and women. So it's just like there's a lot of science even behind the fluidity piece and the arousal and attraction that is super complicated. Yeah. I don't know if that answers your question.
It's so fun. I love that, like, you're talking about male sexuality. I'm talking about female sexuality. Does this sound right? This is what I'm reading in the studies, you know. But that's I think it's great. No, I think you, when you describe male sexuality, again, I like that you said typically. When we say male sexuality, female sexuality, we're talking about generalities. But it does seem to be a pretty, I don't know the percentages, but when we say generally speaking, men are this way, that might be, you know, 80-90% or something. Don't quote me on the percentages, but it's a lot. When women, same thing. When it comes to sexuality, with other things, I think there's less extreme kind of commonalities. But so when I read the studies, and you know, I'm married to my wife, I have three teenage daughters, I have a ministry that I interact with people on this a lot, so this is my full-time job to have these kind of, to try to understand. Mm-hmm. And from what I understand, when I try to understand female sexuality, the lines between romantic, sexual, mm-hmm. emotional, intimate, attraction, or even admiration or even jealousy, like those lines are really fuzzy. So if I look at a dude with his shirt off, and he's super chiseled. He's just in shape, good looking dude, you know, just jawline. He's a couple tats, you know, like, I'm like, dude, that dude is ripped, you know, but that there's a clear line dividing between kind of admiration, maybe even some jealousy and, oh, dude, I find this guy sexually attractive to me. From what I've heard, those lines with women are a little blurry. You know, most women are going to be able to very much admire the physical beauty or even personality of another woman. And being able to separate that admiration, maybe jealousy, maybe even like, man, what would it be like to have boobs like that? Or like, man, her legs, or look at her butt, you know? And like the line between what I would do maybe to another man in admiration and what a woman recognizes, I think, is a little fuzzier, or like, or even emotional. And again, I want to stop in just 30 seconds, cause I don't want to speak beyond, I don't want to get over my skis here and not like, or even if you have like a deep, intimate, emotional bonding with another woman, maybe you're hugging, you're holding hands, maybe it's the other person's sharing a real hard time, they're crying, and then you just feel this deep sense of like, man, this is deeply intimate and I'm bonding with this other person. The line between that and a sexual desire, it can be a lot blurry too. Is that, am I describing that in a way that maybe resonates? Or am I?
Yeah. Especially your second point, with the emotional and romantic sexual attraction being blurred and confusing. Mm-hmm. The first part with the idea of the lines being blurred between like being envious or jealous of a person's appearance versus being attracted to them, like wanting to be with them. I think that's less my experience.
Okay.
But I have definitely heard from other people that they do get confused in regards to that sometimes. Like, am I really attracted? Like, want to be with this person physically, sexually, or am I just, I want to be them? So I've definitely heard that before. It has not been my experience. But the second one definitely resonates with me.
The line between having emotional intimacy versus a sexual desire.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think there's a natural, like, our culture is more accepting of women being affectionate with each other in really public ways and in deeper ways than it is culturally acceptable for men, which I think is ridiculous, but
yeah, totally.
Yeah. But, I think, I don't know. I want to be careful about this conversation too, because the thing I would never want any parent to do is to forbid like their daughters to have friendships, like deep friendships with other girls. Because I think that's often a tendency when they hear like, oh no, the lines can be blurred, so much that this could happen. There's a tendency for parents to be like, oh no, we got to step back and we got to monitor our daughters, make sure they're not getting into too much, physical contact.
Yeah.
I don't know.
How do you balance that though? Cause that,
I
100% I agree. That would be a terrible, like, to start cutting off friendships or whatever. Mm-hmm. At the same time, if you do have a kid that is, I don't know, in a very maybe progressive culture at school, and where, you know, 20% of the girls might be, you know, a bisexual, pansexual, or exploring or whatever, and your daughter might is in that environment, and they're going to be influenced by that, and they have a sleepover with a bunch of girls, and it's like, you know, 20 years ago, you were like, oh, cool, you know, and now it's like, well, I should be maybe as cautious about a sleepover with a bunch of girls I would my daughter going to a sleepover with a bunch of guys. Maybe not as much, but like, I mean, anything can kind of happen. And again, I don't want to, like, I'm a parent, so I get the balance, you know, but like, I don't want to, you overly guard your kids. That's destructive. Mm-hmm. You throw them out into the sea of culture in 2021. And that's also can be irresponsible. Yeah. So
I don't know how you parents do it. I don't know. It's just the balance is so tricky, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't. Yeah, we're not doing it. We're literally just shooting from the hip. Yeah. I mean, us early on, we made a policy as parents: no sleepovers. Period. It's just not. Mm-hmm. We're weirdly like conservative in some ways, and mm-hmm. very progressive in some ways with our parenting. So like, mm-hmm. like two of my four kids have tattoos, and they're under 18.
Okay.
We watch crazy movies. You know, my oldest daughter has gauges and you know, and we homeschool our kids and my mm-hmm. kids aren't allowed to have social media. My teenage daughters don't have any social media. So it's like, we have these weird kind of blend of like puritanical stuff, but then we'll be blaring AC/DC, you know, and dancing and stuff. So I don't know, like I want to, and we don't have sleepovers and we are, mm-hmm. we are very involved in friendships. We want to cultivate healthy friendships with our kids. And if it's an unhealthy friendship, which let's just be honest, the majority of teenagers in this day and age are not pushing each other towards Jesus, you know? And so we hang out with a lot of adults too. Like our kids get along really well with 20 something year olds or even 50 year olds. Sometimes they don't resonate mm-hmm. with 15 or 16 year olds. Because they're not on social media. So when they're hanging out and the other person just staring at their phone, they're like, cool, can I go? You know, like, obviously I don't need to be here.
Such different interests, such a different culture that even they're growing up in, really, it sounds like.
It's weird. It's yeah.
To some extent.
It's parenting in this Gen Z, parenting is a challenge.
Yeah.
Anyway, how would you speak to a parent right now? I imagine there's several dozen, maybe even hundreds of parents listening who might have a teenager who did come out as bisexual, pansexual, probably coupled with maybe non-binary or gender queer. Because mm-hmm. I know the gender with teenagers, the gender and sexual categories are often blurred. Very few lesbians
these
days.
There's a lot of blur.
Probably very few have a 15-year-old that came out as a lesbian. That's kind of an old woman thing in this day and age, mm-hmm. seems like. How would you counsel the parent whose kid recently came out as bisexual, pansexual?
Yeah. So I think, first of all, again, I don't want to make blanket statements, but because each person is an individual who has different experiences, will respond in different ways. First, though, I think even before you find out that your child is identifying as bisexual, before all of that happens, it's so much better to be proactive than reactive. And so just teaching from an early age, like, about sexuality and in ways that are full of grace and truth equally, which of course is a balance that is hard for everyone, but not shying away from those conversations in age-appropriate ways, I think is just super helpful. And I don't see it often. So it's like, I imagine it would be super helpful, but I haven't really seen it. Just fostering a love and a love for God and a desire, to follow him, even when mm-hmm. it's really hard, and to even be open about some of your own things that you have had to sacrifice and how hard it is, and like just fostering more of a open communication around those topics from an early age. But once if you feel like that hasn't happened, I think it gets a lot harder, but it's not like impossible to communicate with your child about these things. I can see that it, like, someone, a parent may be tempted to help their daughter, like, come back to the conclusion that they're straight, that they're just in a phase, that they're just confused.
So that's not a, like, good approach to take, you're saying?
Not at all.
Okay.
Not at all. But,
even if, yeah. Can I just add that this is theology in a row, so I do stuff that's kind of uncut, yeah, and I should probably maybe regret it later, but, like, let me just say it. Even if they are confused, and even if they will be married with, mm-hmm, two kids in 10 years, like,
yeah,
don't assume that, and don't react, yeah, according to that possibility.
And think about, like, what are you communicating to your daughter by framing it in that way? Like, is it the hope of heterosexual marriage? Like, you're putting a lot of hope in heterosexual marriage at that point.
So good. Yeah.
And yeah, what if your daughter actually is gay or bisexual? Like, maybe actually think about that. and how doubting and pushing away those sexual identity questions could end up, like, destroying trust in the relationship. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. So definitely not, the answer is not pushing your child towards straightness, or saying straightness, I guess, or saying it's just a phase, because it feels invalidating for sure.
Yeah, totally. Have you seen parents, I know you don't obviously don't name names or anything, but have you seen parents do that approach and it typically results very negatively?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yes, it backfires too. And yeah, they've had to deal with the fallout of that. And it's very hard once you've broken trust to rebuild it. It's not impossible, but it's just, yeah, to break it in the first place, mm-hmm, if you can. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then I think sometimes pastors or parents can, like, even maybe doubt the confusion that girls are experiencing. Like, well, don't you know if you're attracted to guys exclusively or girls exclusively? Like, mm-hmm, shouldn't it be clear? Like, there's a lack of understanding, again, about what female sexuality is like and how it is confusing. Mm-hmm. And it's okay if your daughter is expressing confusion. It's okay if they're not expressing confusion and they think they know, mm-hmm, and they might know that they are bisexual, mm-hmm, lesbian. I guess not usually lesbian in this age, but yeah, that confusion is a normal experience.
Right. Do you think it would be helpful to, I'm just going to create an imaginary scenario that I know for some of my audience, yeah, is not too imaginary, but your 15-year-old daughter comes home and says, "Mom, Dad, I'm bisexual." Mm-hmm. And then the parent receives them with love and care. "Thanks you for telling me. I know it's a big part of you. Thank you for entrusting me, mm-hmm, with your identity and love you. Always be here for you. Yeah. Want to help you navigate what this looks like in your life, you know?" Mm-hmm. And then the parent, I would think, should maybe go and do some, educate themselves maybe on,
yeah,
if female sexuality, understand. And then, mm-hmm, do you think it would be good for the parent to come back and maybe even help their kid understand, teenage female, understand the maybe complexity of female sexuality and help them maybe even understand the categories of romantic, kind of the stuff we talked about, you know, like, yeah, some of these categories can be blurry and it's natural for you to experience these emotions, or do you think a parent should do that?
Yeah, I think it's dependent probably on the relationship prior to that coming out experience. If the relationship has been one of openness and vulnerability, then yeah, I think it would be great to like ask your child, hey, I've been researching this stuff about just female sexuality and wanted to see what you thought about it. Do you want to talk about it sometime? I think that would be a non-threatening way to approach the topic. And if they say no, then okay, that's that's fine to give them that option of saying no. But then if there is a history of not really being open or vulnerable with these things, that probably closes the door to approaching with that in that way.
Mm. Or even I would say I've seen this back, well, especially with teenagers, sometimes kids are really turned off by parents that are too teachy.
Sure. Yeah.
And they might even receive the same, this how we've seen this happen. We might even receive the same thing for they might receive the same exact thing from just somebody else, you know, who might say, we've had this, you know, where like our kid will come home and like tell us something and like, well, you know, we've been telling you that for years. And
yes. And sometimes it's good. That's a good point too. Like sometimes some of the more difficult and vulnerable teachings can't come from, as much as it feels like it should, it can't come from the parent.
Yeah.
Because teenagers just have a tendency not to be receptive to parents, it seems like, in general.
Yeah.
I mean, that was my experience. If my parents would have come to me and been like, been studying about female sexuality, I mean, in my context, I mean, they wouldn't do that, but if they did, I would have been like, let's not.
can we not have that discussion?
Yeah.
I think probably, I mean, I know in my own context, we have, and part of it, I get, you know, the advantage of this is what I do full time. I've been doing it for a while. Mm-hmm. Our kids are kind of involved. They've heard me give talks and stuff. So for us, having open conversations about sex and sexuality has been a little easier. Until now, it's just the rhythm of our natural conversation. So if they did have questions or thoughts, it would be so natural for them to talk about it. But man, I'll be the first one to admit, if this wasn't my full-time gig or whatever, those are hard conversations. It's hard, it's so embarrassing for a parent, and the kid gets awkward and you get awkward, and it's not easy at all, you know. But if that has been kind of more of a rhythm prior, I love what you said about rather than just reacting, but like having laid the groundwork for these kind of conversations. If the groundwork is laid, it's a lot easier.
Yeah, but unfortunately, a lot of the parents that I hear are expressing these concerns have not laid the groundwork. Mm-hmm. So it is more of a reactive response.
Yeah.
And so I think just finding ways that would be helpful in that space is probably good too.
One more last question and then we'll let you go. Do you know, so like, kind of along the same lines though, like, do you know any resources, maybe YouTube videos or something where a parent could go to send their kid who might be that mitigating voice that helps them navigate their own sexuality in lieu of maybe a parental conversation that might not be the kid's not ready for? Like, who is there something a parent can just go to say, all right, well, then watch this or read this or besides your blogs? I mean, your blogs are amazing, but sometimes kids don't read blogs. But
And the blogs are really a lot to be able to.
I feel like it's more helpful for parents than like a 15-year-old.
Right. You know, yeah. It's definitely directed towards parents and pastors more. But, oh, man, I wish that there was a resource I could point to. I mean, I think the best thing is to find just an older gay Christian, same-sex attracted Christian who has been through some of this stuff and has walked through this part of the journey, and to just bring up to your child that, hey, I know this friend, I know it's super awkward to talk to me about this stuff, but if you ever do want to talk about sexuality to someone I know, such and such person, the hard part is sometimes parents don't know any gay Christians in their life, even though they probably do. They just don't know.
They don't know
that
it.
They know. But I think that would have been really helpful for me. I'm imagining like a Christian gay side B woman, older than me, who I could just talk to and, who I knew like shared some of my lived experience, could be really helpful. So yeah, the difficulty is finding those people, probably.
All the more, to come full circle, all the more reason why I think churches should create contexts where the people who are in their congregation, who have this lived experience, who are walking in faithfulness, have yet another amazing ministry opportunity to be those places where the pastor can point parents saying, hey, you got to talk to this person or this person. They would love to talk to your kid and help you navigate this relationship. Because that lived experience, especially with kids, carries so much weight. And rightly so, right? I mean, who wants to talk to their straight parents, you know, about their bisexuality? Right. Why not talk to a woman who's been living this?
You're not going to understand this at all. Why am I drag?
Lindsay, thank you so much for being on Theology in the Raw. This is, honestly, I've been waiting a year to have this conversation with you. So, I encourage people to go check out Equip Ministries. We just had Peter Falk on the show, the president of your organization. Your blog series, it's called Kiss the Girls, right? On the Equip website?
That is one of the blog titles.
Oh, one of them, okay.
But it's, the series is just by women for women.
By women for women, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, thanks so much for being on the show.
Yeah, thank you so much.